reclaiming who you really are and helping you remember what you didn't know you'd forgotten. Broadcasting to the world, you are listening to Michael Lilborn Williams and the Gospel Revolution.
Welcome to the Gospel Revolution Powercast for Friday, February 9, 2019, broadcasting from the home of redemptionism, where we help you reclaim who you really are and help you remember what you didn't know you'd forgotten. We're coming to you from the heart of the Gospel, where we say that a text without a context is a pretext for a subtext. But right now, with more consistent, persistent, repetitive CPR of the gospel, is the president and founder of the Gospel Revolution, Michael Williams.
Good evening, Donald Bartlett.
Great evening to you.
Thank you so much. Things are well here in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. And spring is just full on up on us here. This is crazy.
Well, I don't know about spring. I mean, after spring, what comes next? In Alabama, it's tornado season.
Yeah, exactly.
So I want it to stay winter.
Well, though, honestly, we've got the spring flowers are 4 or 5 inches out of the ground. And
yes. You Tennesseans have always been hypocrites.
Yeah, well, no doubt about that, but... That's why they call us the volunteer state. We volunteer to be hypocrites.
I love that thing. In America, you've got the show me state.
Yeah.
Is that Mississippi or Missouri or something?
Missouri.
And if you don't show me, I'm not going to believe it. Hey, they should have called it the Thomas state.
So, yeah, no, we are the volunteer state here in Tennessee, and my family is actually closely connected to that Tennessee getting that name, in that during the Mexican-American War, probably of all the wars that America has been in, it's probably the most questionable of ethical, just in its motivations, basically.
Now, when was this?
That was in the late 1840s.
Was this the Spanish-American?
Mexican-American.
Oh, there was a Spanish-American and a Mexican-American.
Yes.
Oh, good Lord, you guys are amazing. So keep telling us about the questionability of this war.
So anyway, the...
Was that Davy Crockett and the Alamo and all of that?
No. That was the Texas Revolution.
Dear God Almighty!
you got your wars all mixed up here, Tom.
Well, mate, it sounds to me, from what I understand about America, they aren't far behind me. But keep going. Tell me this.
So no, this war that was fought, the federal government asked for 3,000 volunteers from the state of Tennessee to go fight in this war, and instead they got 30,000 volunteers to go fight in this war.
Well, they were a bit backward back then. You know, one extra zero, what's that?
Oh, wow. So that's how Tennessee got its name, Volunteer State. My second great-grandfather fought in that war all the way down to Mexico City. Can you imagine a Tennessee boy winding up in Mexico City riding a horse?
Oh, well, it would have been a donkey. It would have been a what the hell do they call them in what do they call
a camel?
Camel. You're outlandish.
Anyway, he lost an eye in the Mexican-American War, and it's where that the U.S. annexed much of the Western territory from Mexico.
Why didn't they keep Mexico City?
There was agreements as to where to draw the lines after the war, and this is where they drew the lines.
Would have been cheaper to build a wall then.
Yeah, well, you know, everybody's telling the Mexicans to get out. I guess the Mexicans really are at home in America. So when you redraw the lines, you can't help it because somebody put your home in a different country.
You know, there are some amazing stories in America about how the states drew their lines up between states.
Oh, there's a lot of really freaky stories about that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Somebody got drunk overnight and they got up and went the wrong direction and then had to compensate and make a little notch out of one of the northern states. I forget which one it was. I remember learning about that in history class in America. I thought that was just the funniest thing in the world. But that was actually the story, the historical story. I don't know that it's documented, but that it's one of those little notches where that there's just a tiny little notch. And they said that they literally went to bed drunk, got up, and went the wrong way the next morning.
So, that is then, too funny. I'd like to live in one of those states where the state line goes right down the middle of the main street, so that on one side of the street you could buy something tax free, and on the other you could buy something else tax free.
I think they have that in South Carolina. We've got one of those towns where the state line runs kind of down the middle of the street. But anyway, that's how Tennessee got its name, the Volunteer State. And the Williams family was very much a part of that name being given, as these guys here in the hills of Tennessee really were, you know, they really were
subject to illiteracy and innumeracy, obviously.
Come on, don't do that to my family now.
I'm doing it to Tennessee. I'm not doing it to your family.
Well, of course not. But another little interesting tidbit around here in this part of the country, in Morgan County, Rome County, it was Nashville that voted to secede from the Union. But the eastern part of Tennessee just was not a part of that at all. And virtually all of the members of my family fought for Lincoln and for the North. Most everybody in East Tennessee did. There was very, very few. I haven't found any myself. None in our families that go back that far, which all of them do. And none of them fought for the South. And it's funny to see the kind of the young guys and stuff around here with their, when you go back to some of these more remote little towns, and they'll have the Confederate flag out or on their truck or something. It's like, wow, if they only knew, you know, that this area never fought for the South at all. So
now, did that have something to do? Look, sorry, family, if you want another podcast, go somewhere else. But did that have something to do?
We're on Tennessee History Month right now.
Yeah. Did that have to do with the fact that Knoxville wanted to be the capital and Nashville wanted to be? See, in Tennessee, and it's one of the very few American topics of which I'm somewhat familiar, if you go from the very east of Tennessee is a long, squashed down, kind of flattened out state that goes from the east. And if you go from Memphis in the west, Elvis's hometown, to the Appalachians in the east, which is the hills and hollows of Lord knows where you might ever be seen again if you go up there, there is a several sub, what's the word for it? There are several subcultures involved there, aren't there?
Oh, yeah. No, in fact, it's called the Three States of Tennessee. And there's West Tennessee, Central Tennessee, Middle Tennessee, they call it, and then East Tennessee. So it's in history, it is called the Three States of Tennessee. So the fact that these operate independently, and because it is such a east-west lying state, their politics were very much east-west lying. And, you know, the only plantations that we really had in Tennessee were in Middle Tennessee and probably Western Tennessee, but there weren't any plantations. You know, slavery was not a big deal, though there were some slaves here, but not by the numbers that there were in Middle Tennessee. And I'm sure still a whole bunch to be learned from that. But as you pointed out so aptly, the people didn't come here to learn about the history of Tennessee.
Well,
but if you have any questions, I'm more than willing to answer.
Send us a letter stuffed with money and we'll answer them. One of the things that endear me to Nashville, where I spent 10 years, is the fact that there are, between Franklin and Nashville, you've got all of these slave fences, slave walls, and they were the walls of fields and paddocks and plantation ownership, and they were built by slaves. And I think I will finish off with this. I've been underneath hotels in the very downtown center of Nashville, and underneath you can see where the slaves used to sleep and live and eat and defecate. And these are the most I promise you, anyone going to Nashville, call me up and I will tell you where to go, where to see these things, because they are not on the tourist strip, I promise you. But, yeah. Michael, welcome to a new podcast.
Oh, one that we seem to be getting into pretty well. We could take one state each quarter and cover the history of the state. I think that would be a fun podcast, actually.
Oh, mate. Well, just take the state, whatever you call it, just take Washington, D.C., and can you just throw it in the general direction of Hawaii? that'd be my wish.
I think everyone would agree on that. Gospel Revolution.
Well, what are we going to do today, Michael?
Well, you know, we made it into chapter 4, but as we were getting ready for this, boy, it just really struck me the beginning of chapter 4 of Hebrews. Now, we have covered chapter 1, 2, 3, and Don, you're going to have to remind me of how far we got down into 4. I think we got down into 6 or 7, somewhere along there.
We did.
But I was drawn back to the beginning of chapter 4, and it just began the juxtaposition of the old covenant to the new covenant. And Paul's, or the writer of this book, I'm really fascinated by what we've explored about the writer of this book, but you'll have to forgive me. I've said Paul for 50 years now, so even though I was open to the fact that somebody else could have written this, I just didn't know who, but now we're beginning to understand there was possibilities of others. But this juxtaposition here, that I think I missed this, and when you miss a juxtaposition in this type of writing, you've missed the whole thing. And that is laying up against the old covenant. And the fact that it has been explained to us that because of unbelief, sin is unbelief. Remember, we went through that and we had it affirmed what the writer of Hebrews calls sin. He calls it unbelief. What does he call unbelief? He calls unbelief sin. So anytime you read one of these two words in this writer's mind, you are talking about sin. You're talking about unbelief. If you're talking about unbelief, you're talking about sin. But he explained that because of the sin of unbelief, that they were not able to enter in. Now, it's interesting that we now, for me, to overlay the fact that they were blinded. That the prophet Isaiah said their eyes were blind. Everybody was blind right straight up until after the deal was done. The deal was done at the cross, and the demand, you know, I always see it like keeping a kitten playing with a ball of yarn on the end of a stick, you know, while you're over here petting the dog or whatever. And when you begin to realize the impossibility of them to believe, as stated by the very same scriptures, it says they did not believe, and the fact that they were blinded all the way up through the cross for sure, and then Paul says that many still remain blinded by the same law, by their affection for and adherence to Moses and the traditions of the old covenant, that it has a blinding power that stays on them, he said, until this day. So as we look at this, and then we go into chapter 4, he has told how powerful unbelief is. That's what he's gotten across. Unbelief is so powerful, it stopped God from doing anything. Unbelief is so powerful, it kept them out. Unbelief is so powerful that they never received the promise. Unbelief is just that powerful and a little bit more. Then he starts out chapter 4 with, "Let us therefore fear lest the promise being left us of entering into his rest, any of you should seem to come short of it." Now, I think it's interesting. He said that any of you, that if even one of you would seem to come short of it. Well, now, that sounds a little bit facetious to me, because obviously if it's based on our belief, any of us would always be subject to not entering into rest because of our own unbelief. But here is where this really comes down to the writer of Hebrews putting the nail in this, as showing that if it is still belief that is required, you are as incapable of believing as they were. And if you are as incapable of believing as they were, then you've got nothing left to do but fear. I mean, a fear that is absolutely proven of unbelief as to what it would do. So here we have Paul saying, "Let us fear," you know, and then I was drawn to the fact that, you know, Paul uses this term in, I think it's actually coming up soon here, where he said that if you sin again, that you have nothing to do except but to wait for the to fear the fiery indignation of God. And then remember again, he said in this same, the writer of this book said that that the sight of the mount was so terrifying that Moses said, "I exceedingly fear and quake." You see, the writer of this book understood that fear of judgment was real.
Well, is that not what the prophet said when he said, "And God will wipe away tears from all faces," because in the very same breath he's talking about judgment, isn't he?
He's talking about judgment. He's talking about this judgment being passed and at a point which we understand to be the cross. And then this powerful thing that happened that that wiped tears from all faces. And again, for those of you who have not heard these, we are we're really focusing in on, we want to focus in on this verse just a moment, and that is that it's quoted wrong all the time. The New Testament translators put it down as that God will wipe all tears from their faces. And the implication is that all the tears are gone off of some faces of those who made it. But the prophecy actually says that God shall wipe the tears from off all faces.
Thank God.
Which is a tremendously different. One is the gospel. The other one is Christianity. I mean, that's basically basically the difference. And by that one verse, actually, you can see how that the New Testament was translated in the support of Christian doctrine. So, and we could do that for you all day long. That sounds like a good whole year study, is to show how that verses were translated out of the Old Testament. And the scriptures were translated when they were quoted to support Christianity rather than to support the gospel. And folks, that's just a fact. And we've just gone through that one. So here the writer of Hebrews is showing us that there's got to be something different about this covenant. And if believing is a part of this covenant and believing was a part of that covenant, now, he makes the statement that they heard the gospel just like we're hearing the gospel. They didn't mix it with faith, therefore they didn't get it. So if the same application is here now after Christ, well, we don't have anything but fear, because we have an entire Jewish nation that failed at two things, at keeping the law and at believing. They failed at both of these.
And both of those things stopped them from entering into God's
into
rest.
The rest. Absolutely. The thing of it is, Don, is that we've already been told that this today would be the day that would give them rest. Because if today had happened to them, they would have been at rest. Today didn't happen to them. I think it's just so interesting. Now, I've never looked at this word. You know, it's funny to me. I've never looked at it. Maybe you want to glance at it. This, why is this hyphenated? And why is this word today, which we now spell without a hyphen, why is this word hyphenated? Is there anything lurking there?
No, it's today's today, but it's just like the word holiday. The word holiday started off as holy dash day.
I got you. Okay.
And it's been, yep.
All right. So just a cultural change to that, no definition or understanding change to it. All right.
It's just a function of time.
Yes. So let's start in verse 7 and just start reading down through there. And let's make sure we identify this today. Now, what's going to happen, let me warn you as we proceed in this, just so that the thought can connect to the next understanding of what Jesus is. We've compared him to angels. We've compared him to Moses. And now you're finding out that he is our today. He's our today that the today they didn't get, the today we got. And when we got the today, they got the today too, because we got the today.
So there is this fear attached to unbelief, attached to, well, actually, it seems to be attached to failure, the failure to enter into the rest, which in turn appears to be resting on the fulcrum of unbelief or belief and sin. Being the same thing. So let us go forward, as you said, to verse 7. And in this whole entering into rest thing, we see that the gospel was preached to ancient Israel. Somehow it didn't believe it. We know that from John 12. In fact, we know it also from Isaiah. There is none righteous, no, not one. No believer was good enough to qualify. And then we realize that David, centuries later, after Joshua was supposed to lead these people into rest, he says, so there's still a day of rest. And so this writer is saying, so there is a day of rest, huh? And it still has not been entered into. So let's take it
and
up
and a day
this.
Of rest from fear, one could say.
Yes.
And which takes us back to Hebrews chapter 2, verse 15. And deliver them who through fear of death were all their lifetime subject to bondage. So this is the beginning of Hebrews. So see, we have grabbed hold of a thread here. And the writer is profound, whoever he is. And he is making sure that he takes this thread of fear in pertaining to them and to us and shows how that this thread leads straight to the cross. So they were all their lifetime subject to bondage through fear of death. So this thread is very clear from here. Now, this is who through fear of death were all their lifetime subject to bondage. That's Hebrews 2:15. And we take that all the way through Hebrews.
Hebrews.
Well, Hebrews. Who wrote Hebrews?
That's a question. Hey, listen, I've got a thought. We keep kind of apologizing, you and I both, because of the disputed claim of authorship of Hebrews. Now, this book is...
And the unstated claim of authorship in the book of Hebrews.
Well, you know, according to which... It should never have made it into the canon, because any book in the canon should have been written by an apostle or the intimate confidant of an apostle. No one knows who the hell wrote Hebrews. But can I save us all some time and bother here? Why don't we just say Paul or Paul's logic? Because that's what it is here, and it could very easily be Paul. No one I mean, that's what the earliest church fathers thought that Paul wrote it. So what? We keep vacillating between, well, when Paul, the writer of Hebrews, why don't we just say Paul and be done with it? And family, if you don't like it, gosh, we're really sorry, but we're lazy. We're too lazy to keep saying the writers of Hebrews.
And we may use any and all of the above affirmations also. So
no. As it suits us.
So anyway, we start out in Hebrews 2, and delivered them who through fear of death were all their lifetime subject to bondage, all the way through Hebrews 12 then. And so terrible was the sight that Moses said, I exceedingly fear and quake. Now, and what is this fear based in? It's based in unbelief. That's what my statement was. The fear produced by unbelief. The fear of unbelief. That is where all of this fear is based. And let me tell you, when you are being required to believe and you can't even obey, how can you say you've believed when you can't obey? How can you say you've obeyed when you can't believe? It's just one of those damned if you do, damned if you don't scenarios that was set up by God to lead us to this magnificent revelation of the cross.
Well, I would say lead us to absolute and utter frustration. Wouldn't you?
Well, not anymore. No,
but going back to then.
Yes, for them, yes. It would have led them to fear, frustration, all kinds of phobias and lack of confidence, lying. You know how many times they lied to God? And they looked God right in the face. And I've always said to be a good Christian, you got to be a good liar. Let me tell you, you put somebody under the threat of having to believe, they'll lie to God's face. They'll tell God, oh, yeah. God, it wasn't me. God, it wasn't me. Yeah, you know, well, Lord, you know, this happened. And how many stories can come to mind about the places where that all these people who had these direct encounters with God looked him right in the face and lied to him?
Well, that and excuses. Well,
lies and excuses. Oh, yes. Not a healthy way to live, especially in front of God, I suppose. And it's not a healthy way to live inside yourself. And folks, here we get to the real where the rubber meets the road about the gospel. You don't have to live in these types of fears. Now, there's phobias of heights and things. I'm not talking about those. But I'm talking about the fear of failing God, the fear of not making it, the fear of eternal life or the lack thereof. These fears, we have no clue how that these things, you can be the chief politician of a country, you can be a great philosopher, you can be a great mathematician, and in the background is running this horrible, dreadful fear of death, fear of unbelief.
There is something about radio waves that I want to just touch on. Radio waves, actually the sound you hear coming through your radio rides on top of a wave.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that what I'm saying is not entirely accurate, but it's accurate enough for those of you purists in audio that you know what I'm talking about. The somebody's voice, it and the music and everything you hear coming over this radio station is riding on top of the waves. The waves are this subtext. Mm-hmm. Which you don't know, you can't read, you can't see, you can't understand. You can hear what's happening on top of the waves. Every time it comes up to the top of the wave, you're hearing what is happening on the top of that wave. Now, that is like humanity. I lived my life on a subtext beneath the top of the wave. On top of the wave was, I'm born again, I'm going to heaven.
Yes.
Underneath was, I wonder if today I have lived good enough that no sin will come between me and God when I get to the pearly gates. Now, and like Mike just said, you could be the president of a country and you still, particularly in some countries, wonder if you're going to go, how long you're going to be in purgatory, whether you're going to go straight to God, whether you're ever even going to see God. What the hell's going to happen when I die?
And how much that affects your daily decisions and how you face and deal with life and deal with yourself.
Absolutely.
So, you know, and that's what the gospel does. It gets down to this frequency level, you know, and all we've ever done is behavior modification. We have tried to alter how people ride the wave. But you see, folks, the gospel changes what the wave is. It's a very predictable wave.
Say that again.
The gospel doesn't change how you ride the wave. The gospel changes the wave you are riding.
Wow.
And completely dissolves the other one. And you begin to wonder. That's why you wake up different than you were before. That's why you wake up with things that have been altered that you had no influence over. You had no conscious. You weren't trying to learn how to ride the surfboard. Just suddenly you were up and running. You don't know how it happened. That's happened to me for many years now. It seems to never stop, Don.
Get old?
I mean,
never get
even
old?
It never gets old. All right. So let's continue reading. And for those of you tracking through, folks, sometimes when we go through these things, it's like walking down the middle of a diamond field. And, you know, you're picking up diamonds as you go, and you're picking up some small diamonds, and then you pick out one, two, or three off of the wall, and then you turn around and look, and you see, oops, we dislodged a really big diamond back there. So you got to go back and pick up the big diamond. You wouldn't say, oh, no, we got to stay on the journey here for the sake of the journey. The journey is about picking up these diamonds, this understanding. And if we have to backtrack to go through this trot through this part of the whole mining system, we'll back up and we'll go after it. And I think that this is I think we're all finding this to be very fascinating, the things that are coming up, even though we covered this material already. Don, pick us up where we were, and let's go on.
Verse 7, we're going to take it up from there. Again, he, by drawing boundaries around a certain day, limits it to that certain day. That's I'm reading from the King
Jimmy.
That's
so good.
The King Jimmy. I'm just translating on the fly here, family. He limits it to a certain day, saying, in David, today, after...
Tell me what the word limited means.
It means to draw boundaries around a thing.
Wow. I love that.
If you marked out a field, a survey, if you surveyed a field and you put fence posts around it, that's what it means.
Wow.
And the word in Greek is horizo. Horizo is the word from which we get horizon. You know, it's a boundary.
Yeah.
So again, he identifies an absolutely certain day, saying in David, today, after so long a time, as it is said, today, if you hear his voice, harden not your hearts.
Yeah.
Cardia. For if Jesus had given them rest, now that word is Joshua, for if Joshua had taken them over into the promised land and given them rest, then would he not have afterwards spoken of another, then why did he speak later of another day? That is David.
Yeah.
Well, because there remains, therefore, a rest to the people of God.
From that point of the story.
Being
so vitally important.
Being in David, being by David several centuries after Joshua led them into the promised land.
And after that fact, there still, even after that, there was still a day. Today had not come even at that point. There remaineth, therefore, a rest to the people of God. Now, this is, and it's important that we stop on this point just a moment, Don, because it's going to take some shaking to get this thing loose from people's brain. Because how many hundreds, if not thousands of times, depending on how many sermons you've listened to. Well, there remaineth therefore rest. And I'm telling you, you won't enter into rest until you give. You can't enter into rest until you
obey. Hallelujah.
Oh my gosh. It just is, you know, it sounds so innocent, but it's so deadly, Don.
Can I get an amen? Now, in Australia, we don't have adult Sunday school. By the time you're an adult, you're considered intelligent enough or schooled enough not to need adult Sunday. But anyway, can I give you the Aussie Sunday school, which is all kids, version of what I'm hearing you say? Joshua was appointed by God to lead the people of God into rest. They didn't get it because they didn't believe God. They saw miracle after miracle after miracle and couldn't get in, just still didn't believe. And unbelief is sin. So because of this unbelief and sin, they could not enter into the rest of God. So several centuries later, King David, writing under the inspiration of God, says, so there still remains a day of rest. And this is several centuries later. Mm-hmm. And then this writer, many centuries after even David, says, so can you see this pictograph of the past? Can you see this pictorial where unbelief and sin stopped people entering into something called rest? And it didn't happen once, but it happened many times, because centuries later another King David said the same, said that they couldn't enter into rest. And therefore, even in King David's day, there still remained, even though these people of Israel had all the laws and covenants and sacrifices and priests and God knows what, there still remained a bloody rest. Yeah. So this writer is now making, have I got the Sunday school version of this right?
I think you're doing good.
All right.
So let's read on. Now, we're making sure that we've held fast to the point that the writer is at this during this broadcast and at this point of his writings. And we're going to continue on from there.
There remains, therefore, a rest to the people of God, because enterers into his rest have also stopped trying in their own right. Mm. So in the King James, he says, because he that entered into his rest, he also has ceased from his own works, as God did from his works. Now, when did that happen? It happened on the seventh day. What were the works of God? The works of God were to bring all humanity into himself. Mm-hmm. When did he rest from that? When did he? When was all of that set up so that it never needed another bit of input? It happened on the seventh day. Let us labor, therefore, verse 11 of Hebrews 4, to enter into that rest, lest any man.
Yep.
Falls after the same example of unbelief.
Wow. All right. So there's still a way in that has not, at this point of the story, not from this point in history, but at this point in the story, there still has not found a way in, because today has not happened.
Now, what you're making a difference there between this point in history when Hebrews was written and this point in the story, which was earlier.
And both, not just this point in history when Hebrews was written, but not in this point in time. Here in February of 2019. It's not talking about from right now either. And that's where people are really stuck. They still think that this is talking about something unfulfilled. We're talking about something in a chronological order that we're going to let the author of this show us. So now, what is belief? Belief is a profession of faith. Remember how that he described to us in Romans, as described to us in Romans, that if you believe in your heart and confess with your mouth, right? So a profession is very much a part of this whole thing called belief. So Don, go on. Let's see if we can find some resolve to this somewhere.
Well, Well, I want to tie it back to verse 2 again.
Oh, yes.
Or 3. Because in verse 3 it says, because believers enter into rest.
Mm-hmm.
Because believers enter into mm-hmm. rest. Unbelievers can't enter into rest. Okay. Where did I get up to?
So, I'll tell you, such a beautiful picture of the gospel is coming together here.
Isn't it great? It's just, I wish I had forever to just delve into this stuff. It's just, okay. There remains therefore a rest to the people of God. So if only believers enter into rest, a la verse 2, and it says here in verse 10, there remains therefore a rest to the people of God. We know that there's some believers somewhere. We know there's a believer because if there remains a rest, then only the believers get in. Then, for he that has entered into his rest, he has also ceased from his own works. We find out something about these believers. They don't bother working anymore. They don't bother spending energy on, you know, trying to earn brownie points with a God that's no longer keeping score. What they're doing is they're just relaxing. It's like those pictures of angels on clouds strumming harps. I mean, it sounds like a bloody awful, boring thing to me, but it's fully rest. Let us labor, therefore, to enter into that rest. Well, hang on. You just said that the people who've rested from their bloody labors, and now you're saying, okay, let me just read it. Let us labor, therefore, to enter into that rest. The word labor is different from the word works, but it means to expend effort. To raise a sweat. Let us labor, therefore, to enter into that rest, lest any man fall after the same example of unbelief that won't let you in to the rest.
And Don, tell us what that is. There anything different about this word unbelief? Let's just look at it here in verse 11.
It is. It's not pisteo, it's pitheo or pitheia, and it has the prefix of a, meaning without, apatheia, from which we get the word pathetic.
Is it disobedience?
No, it's not. It's not disobedience. It's unbelief that is rooted in the fact that it's impossible to be persuaded of something.
I like that.
And it's the same word, root, from which we get pathetic, antipathetic, sympathetic, and so forth. It's patheia, or in this case, apatheia, meaning unpersuadability.
Okay, so Don, this is not, see, we deal with the term unbelief here. We always deal with unbelief as a choice.
But what if it's not a choice?
So are you telling me that this word unbelief is showing that there is no choice?
Well, you can't believe that which your heart does not accept. Mm-hmm. This is for me, a given fact.
And in this case, possibly what your heart has been blocked from accepting.
Well, let's try this out, just you and me. I want you to believe right now, and I want you to be totally logical in this, Michael. I want you to believe right now that the sky is made of pink marshmallow. I don't want you to imagine it. I don't want you to see it in your mind. I want you to actually believe that the sky is made of pink marshmallow and that green jelly fills every single river on the face of the earth.
Hold on a minute. Could you wait until after I've had my morning meds? I might be able to then.
But can you believe that?
No, I cannot.
How can anyone? This is the joke when people say, "Just believe in your heart that Jesus rose from the dead," and say it with your mouth, Romans 10:9. Just believe it, and Jesus will come into your heart. How the hell do you believe something your heart can't believe? How does your mind accept something your heart rejects? So, can we apply that to this?
Yes. And I think even to a greater extent, something that your heart has been preordained to not accept.
And hence conditioned against. Yes.
Yes.
Wow. This is good stuff.
So, I mean, this is, so we've got to see this ironclad thing. I mean, goodness gracious. Now, what we've got so far is that only a believer can enter in, right?
Yes.
Only a believer can enter in.
Yes.
The reason they didn't enter in is because they had it imposed upon them to not believe.
And that word is pisteo, pisteo, the Greek word for faith. Sorry, keep going.
Yes.
And this word is patheo, which is a Greek word for not being able to believe if your life depended on it. Exactly the same as back in John 3:19.
So a believer can get there, but somebody who's had it imposed on them not to believe can't possibly get there. The dividing line here is just absolutely getting stronger and more brilliant for us to see. Now, this brings to my mind something that I covered on the Tuesday night Bible study.
Wasn't that something? Hey, listen, family, if you're not looking at these videos every Tuesday night, it comes out of Oak Ridge, Tennessee, by no less than our prophet in charge, Mr. Mickle Williams, mate and matesses. This is me saying family, mates and matesses. Go watch this. It's on 5:30 Eastern Standard Time, I think it is. 6:30 Eastern Standard Time, which is, God, you know, if you're in Vietnam, who knows. But go watch these. This is Mike at his best, pulling out of his heart. I was going to say pulling out of his back. Well, no, he's pulling out of his heart all of that which has taken several decades to
smushing it down to 15 minutes
and doing a great job. Sorry, mate. Keep going.
No, thank you. And this last one I really enjoyed tremendously. I hope you will also, because I'm going to make a reference to it, is that we pulled up the verses in John that said where the disciples ask him, what must we do to do the works of God?
Mm.
And Jesus said, this is the work of God.
Now, when he said that, he identified, that was a great chance for him to say, oh, don't be silly, you can't do the works of God. But no, he didn't say that. What did he say, mate?
He said, this is the work of God, to believe on him whom God has sent. Now, I think we missed two things. Number one, the first thing is that he identified it as a work. Now, we compared that to Ephesians, says it's not by works, lest any but man should boast, the grace nor the faith. Mm. And we tore that apart. We just went into that and how that Christianity says, well, the grace is from God, but the faith is from you. And that's just not in there whatsoever in any degree in those verses in Ephesians chapter 2.
Nice try, though.
It was a good try, but when you must, you must. And they must, because the entire thing is going to come crumbling down once this fallacy is exposed around the world. So not only has he identified this in this thing called belief as a work, he also identified it as a work of God. So who is the only one who can do a work of God?
Let me think for a moment now. That is so cool.
This is a work of God. It is a work of God to believe. It is a work. Folks, let me stand and shout it as many times as I can. It is a work of God to believe. It is the grace of God. It is the mercy of God. It is the faith of God. It is the love of God. It is the kindness of God. Oh, how we reached in and took this one element called belief and said, we'll do that one. We'll do that one. Why don't you just go ahead and do grace also? Why don't you go ahead and do mercy? Have mercy on the whole human race.
Yeah, love. Love everybody. Love. Oh, man. God is love. So, yeah.
So, this is a work of God. Folks, Jesus made it clear. Number one, it is a work. And God ceased from all his labors. Right?
Yes.
And it is a work of God. Faith is a work of God. It's not a work of God in you so that you can do it. It is a work that God does.
When he believes in himself.
Yeah. Powerful. Wow. Let's continue on.
I think we're up to verse 12. For the word of God is quick and powerful and sharper than any two. This may be the second most well-known verse in the Bible. For the word of God is quick and powerful and sharper than any two-edged sword, piercing even to the dividing asunder of soul and spirit and of the joints and marrow, and is a discerner of the thoughts and intents of the heart.
Now, he's talking about belief. So if you're going to want to try to fake it about believing, just in case you're going to try to fake this, just in case you're going to try to pull one over on God and tell him how much you believe, just remember this.
Neither, verse 13 of chapter 4 of Hebrews, is there...
Oh, are you a believer? Are you a believer? Let's read verse 13.
Neither is there any creature that is not manifest or nude or naked in his sight, but all things are nude or naked and opened unto the eyes of him with whom we have to do.
Wow. So now let your belief be examined not by the preacher. Let your belief be examined by God. See where it stands.
I can fool the preacher.
You can even fool yourself.
Gospel Revolution.
This whole thing has been about belief. And just in case you are going to try to take this on yourself, just look at the scrutiny that your belief is going to get, right? So where do we turn? I mean, if we can't fake it.
which is what Christianity is all about, fake it till you make it.
Then what are we going to do? Verse 14. Seeing then, oh my gosh, oh wow. Finally, we're going to be doing what? Seeing.
You want to read this or do you want me to do my job?
Thou goest ahead, my friendeth.
Seeing then that we have a great high priest that is passed into the heavens.
Into his rest.
Jesus, the Son of God. Let us,
wow, the one who believed.
The one who believed. Let us hold fast our.
That's so nasty.
Well, actually, the word is not profession of faith, it's confession. Homologia is the Greek way of saying homo same logia, speak, to speak the same as. Now, when we took that into Latin, we called it to confess, con, with, fessio, to speak, if you know your Latin roots. And so we essentially translated it through two languages to confess. And then in English, we totally changed the meaning. We said, no, confess means you got to bawl and squall and hit the floor with both your hands and repent and da-da-da-da-da, or do it in front of a priest. No.
And what Greek word does the word our come from?
It ain't there. It just says.
It just ain't there.
The Son of God, let us hold fast homologeo. So let us hold fast to saying the same thing as God says.
And remember, everything that was a what became a who. So who is our homologeo?
Well, it goes back, if you remember, to I think the first couple of verses of chapter 2, that we have to hold fast to our profession. We have to hold fast to, and who is our profession? It's Jesus.
He is the high priest that is the profession of our faith.
And the apostle of our calling.
And the apostle and high priest of the profession of faith. Now, you can call it ours or not, but please don't mistake. See, this is what I was taught. If you believe and confess, Jesus will take that confession to the Father.
Yeah.
Now, that's just nowhere in context, content, Greek, Hebrew, Russian, Hindi, or anything else. It's just not here, folks.
Well, let me read this verse. Seeing then that we have a great high priest. So he's saying we've got a great high priest, and seeing that we've got that, that is passed into the heavens, and then he identifies as Jesus Christus, or Jesus, Theos, Jesus, the Son of God. Let us hold fast.
Mm-hmm.
Jesus, the Son of God,
yeah,
who is the profession of God.
Wow. Yeah, that's awesome. Well, and for what reason? Now, what should motivate us to hold on to Christ as the profession of faith instead of being, now we've already seen why we need to let go of our own attempt to believe. Number one, it was tried on Israel. They all failed. They all failed. They failed because they had been doomed to fail, if you will, confined to failure of belief. Then he's told us, now, if you're going to try to fake believing, just remember this. The two-edged sword dividing right down to the middle of your thoughts and the way you think and what your true motivations are. Don't think you're going to trick God into thinking that you've got belief. But what we need to do, though, is hold fast the profession of faith, who is Christ. And now, why should we hold fast to that profession of faith?
Because the word in Greek is ga. Because we have not got a high priest who can't be touched with the feelings of our...
This is good. What does the word infirmity mean? What does the word infirmity mean?
What it means, boy? What it means?
What it means?
Well, it means feebleness I'm going to take it even further than that.
An inability.
Exactly. Exactly.
So an inability to do what? What has been the subject?
Belief.
Belief. He is not a high priest that cannot be touched with the feelings. Tell me the word feelings of our unbelief. Context, infirmity is unbelief.
It's sympatheo. It comes from the same word, patheo, as that earlier word we talked about, which was not pisteo, but patheo, and it means it doesn't mean empathy, although it really should be. No, I'm going to say it means empathy. Some people would.
So he's empathetic to our unbelief.
And why not? He was
now. How could he be empathetic to our unbelief?
Well, as you taught earlier, there was nothing that we are tempted by that he was not tempted by. And when we looked into that carefully, we realized that that was a temptation for us to try and be self-sufficient in our pleasing to God.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a major part, Don, of the telling of the story of Christ. This is the temptation of Christ. And it's not Mary Magdalene. I don't care what movie you went to see in the 1970s that Christianity made very popular by opposing it.
Now, here's a question I've never... was it really a temptation if he couldn't have failed?
The only thing that we know is that he was tempted after fasting 40 days. So... he went through as much of a weakening process as possible.
In which his natural body and natural mind would undoubtedly have been affected.
Yes, 40 days without food. So he placed himself in a point as near man as he possibly can by depleting himself of all nourishment for 40 days. And then what was he tempted with? Folks, it's just so foolish to think that Jesus was tempted to kiss Marilyn Monroe, or Jesus was tempted to do drugs. And, you know, now was he tempted to do meth? Because that only came along until, you know, the last couple of decades. And was he tempted with chocolate? I don't even know they had chocolate back then.
Man, I'm telling you, I'd do more than kiss Marilyn Monroe. I'm not sure if that should go to me.
So the we know what he was tempted with. If you are the Son of God, prove it. You see, if Jesus had done something to prove he was the Son of God, that would have been called unbelief.
Well, certainly self-righteousness.
Mm-hmm.
Which I guess is?
It is unbelief. It can't be described as anything else but. So you see, suddenly now this whole verse now falls into proper perspective as we go through this. Now that we know that Jesus is the profession of our faith, then let's close this show out by reading verse 16 and seeing what we can glean from that, Don.
You just finished this verse. I don't think I finished it. For we have not a high priest. We don't have a high priest which can't be touched with the feelings of our weakness or our limitations, with the empathy with them, who cannot be touched with empathy for our limitations, but was in all points tempted like as we are, yet without sin. Let us therefore come boldly unto the throne. Now what he's doing, see that there?
Yeah, without unbelief then, according to this chapter.
Uh-huh. And he's saying therefore, meaning after laying all of this out in front of you, I've just thrown this out like as clearly as I can. He says, therefore, let us come boldly unto the throne of grace, that we may take, it's not obtain, but we may take mercy. You dip into that mercy and you just take as much as you want and find grace to help in time of need. And what would be our time of need, Mike?
That's a very good question. Based on the context of this, is when you are tempted to add works to your redemption, folks. Let me tell you something. You are in a time of need. Based on context, you could take this. Oh, it could be any need you got, brother and sister. But I'm telling you, you're taking it far out of context of what it is talking about. The time of need is a time of reliance on your own belief. If you start relying on your own belief, you're in a time of need, folks. You need to stop and reevaluate quickly, very quickly. You need to go to that, quote, throne of grace. You need to reevaluate this whole situation, because let me tell you where that throne of grace is. It's right inside of you. You're not going to have to travel off to some foreign universe. You're not going to have to try to reach through with praise and thanksgiving to try to get to God, to try to get to that throne. That throne has been set up in your heart. It's called the kingdom of God, where the king resides, and that's inside of you. So always reach inside of you. We've always told you, reach inside of you. Follow your heart. Why can you follow your heart? Number one, it's where the throne of grace is. Number two, you'll always find help in the time where you are wavering back toward religion. After all, isn't this entire book about wavering back toward religion? Isn't the time of need addressed by the writer of Hebrews? Is this time of need not exactly described as the time of going back to Moses, back to the sacrifice, back to ceremony, back to obedience to the law, back to judgment, back to guilt, and back to failure? Isn't that what this is all about? So wouldn't it stand to reason this would be the time of need for you?
And so it is that we must leave you, family and friends. If you would like to know anything about the Gospel Revolution, then call our office on
832-318-9339.
And speak to the boss about how you want to participate, or go to www.gospelrevolution.com. Hit any link you want. I prefer the donate link, but you can go on the comment, or you can go on the connect. You can just watch a video, or you can listen to podcasts. Thousands of hours of material that have been put out there by the Gospel Revolution and Mike Williams Ministries. But hit any link you want and just enjoy yourself. But now, it's good night from myself, Don Bartlett, from the GR Studios right here in Gospel City, USA.
And it is good night from Michael Williams right here in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. And we love you guys. Thank you so much. Pledge Drive was successful indeed. And we still got people calling in. We've still got people going in on PayPal and just boom. I'm seeing names on there I've never seen before. I don't know these people. But they know us, and the more important thing is by doing this, not only are they hearing the gospel, they're getting it. They're getting it enough to support it. So, folks, you should be so excited for 2019 here in the Gospel Revolution. We are something happening, and it's based on the years of dedication that we've had and the commitment that people have had to getting the gospel out. I'm very protective of that effort and this effort, and we will do whatever means we can to continue to promote the gospel around this planet through whomever that we can solidly rely on to do that. We're in a really good position all the way around, and thank you so much, all of you that participated in the pledge drive. We are so very grateful.
We shall hope that you enjoyed today's PowerCast. And remember, we'll be here to do the same thing all over again next week.
I bet it'll be better.
Gospel Revolution.